Crusades were definitely a mess. Awful mess. Tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children died on a failed quest to reclaim the Holy Land, setting off centuries of animosity, hatred, fear, loathing, disgust between the East and the West, between Byzantium and Europe, between Islam and Christianity, all for nothing. But the sad part is, that's not all that was going on in and around the time period. Best analogy I can make, put on the news, any day of the week, any day of the week. Put the news on and look at all of the bad stuff that's going on in the world today, right now. Just in our country, we got millions of illegal immigrants oozing across our border. We got gang violence in cities. We got inflation. You know, we just mess after mess after mess after mess. And that's just today. But think of all the bad things that's happened in your lifetime. I'm sure all of you were born around the time of 9/11. We had two wars that happened, which ended miserably. We had death, we had destruction, we had chaos. And then stretch it back even further. Go back 100 years. You got Vietnam, you got World War II, Korea, World War I. Just violence, chaos, death, and destruction. The same was true for the people alive back during these period we know as the Middle Ages. At around the time the Crusades came to an end, good times did not just suddenly begin for those people alive in Europe. It just continued to be bad. Problem after problem after problem. We're going to talk about some of the biggest ones. And we're going to begin with one that you probably didn't ever even realize impacted Western Europe. And that would be a crisis triggered by the emergence of the Mongols. Who were these Mongolian peoples? Well, they were nomads, meaning they didn't have towns and cities. They traveled. They migrated. They appeared in the grasslands north of China. They lived in felt tents, which were called yurts. They raised horses and sheep. And they literally migrated with the seasons, going from pasture to pasture so they could feed their animals. Who are you?
Matthew.
Their chiefs were elected, typically from the most noble lineages, but what allowed them to get there was their masculinity, their courage, their military prowess, their ability to make strong, firm judgments, and their ability to lead men. They didn't elect weak leaders because they knew weak leaders would lead to their destruction. They were what we would call pagan. They worshipped nature deities. Their most powerful god was the sky god, Tengri. The sky god was the most powerful because does not the sky sit above all? But they were politically divided into tribes. We all know what a tribe is, right? What's a tribe? Group of people, but how are they connected?
They communicate in common language.
Yeah, okay. So the common culture, common language, yeah.
Common language. think.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. What's another connection that the tribes have? Believe it or not, they're all kind of related to one another. They're extended family. They're groups that stick together. So you have all of these peoples all separated into different groups. And they frequently warred amongst themselves. By the way, they also did the same. They also attacked anybody who lived within the periphery of the lands that they migrated in. So long story short, they loved war. Well, the tribal structure of these people would change with the coming of a man born with the name Temujin. Temujin was born 1167. So time frame around the time of the Second Crusade. He himself was the son of a tribal chief, so he was potentially in line to become a chief himself, of course, if he could prove himself. But unfortunately, while he was still a boy, there was a coup d'etat in his tribe, and his father was poisoned. And out of sheer luck, he managed to escape into the wilderness, or the killers of his father probably would have killed him. But while wandering the vast grasslands, he eventually would come of age, develop a strong skill set, would return to his tribe, and he would avenge the death of his father. And his people elected him tribal chief. But then he used his brain. He made shrewd political alliances with other tribes. Tribes that he had come in contact when he was wandering, homeless. And these alliances, along with remarkable survival skills, allowed him eventually to unite all of the tribes into a single nation. Well, then every single one of the tribes voted, and they would elect him Genghis Khan, which means great ruler, the equivalent of an emperor. Well, once the great Khan in this position could not allow war going on amongst his people anymore, so he unleashed his tribes, his tribal armies on the world. Now, the funny thing is, scholars differentiate reasons why he did this. There is a legend that says at one point, one of the influential Mongol shaman met with him and proclaimed that it was the will of Tengri that Genghis would conquer all beneath the sky. In other words, the most powerful god gave Genghis his blessing to conquer the world. But there seems to be factual evidence that kind of, you know, undermines that legend. There's a few quotes that are attributed to him. And of the many quotes, this is the one that I think really kind of gives you a good picture into probably what this guy was thinking. And I quote, you don't have to write this down, just listen. Man's highest joy is in victory. To conquer one's enemies, to pursue them, to deprive them of their possessions, to make their beloved weep, to ride on their horses, to embrace their wives and their daughters. He was a man's man's man. He wanted to beat his enemies because he could, and he liked it. Now, by the way, how many of you realize that during the wars that he started, he's responsible for a death toll that amounts to 5% of the world. The world's population in during when he was alive. And how was he able to do it? Organization. He developed a military strategy that many modern armies today utilize. And it was unheard of back then. He didn't just have one mega force. But what he did is he made units of soldiers. He divided his troops up into units of 10,000 soldiers. So that way each of these units could go in multiple directions. And then within those 10,000 units, there were further subdivisions. So the 10,000 would be divided into 1,000, which would be divided into 100, down to the lowest unit, which was 10, like a squadron. Each of these different units had one man that was responsible for all the people in that level. If the unit failed, that would be the guy that would get killed. Because you can't blame the men, you blame the leader for failure. But because of this bond, it allowed them to develop a close-knit relationship. So for instance, we all know how the Mongolians fought, right? How did they fight?
Win by any means possible.
Yeah, but what was their major tactic that they used?
Guerrilla.
Did they fight with infantry? Anybody know? No? Cavalry. They fought on horseback. So they used an equivalent of blitzkrieg. And their primary weapon was a bow. Well, if you've ever ridden a horse hoofs when they hit the ground kind of loud. Imagine you're riding a pack of 10 or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 horses. Well, these units each had their own hand gestures. Like base coaches in baseball or softball, that each of the men in the unit would know what they're talking about. So they didn't have to yell. They could just do the hand gestures and they all could move as one. Their tactics were superb. They could attack. They could retreat. They could outflank. They could turn. They would do anything on a battlefield to destroy their enemies. They basically sowed chaos. And nothing could stop them. Now, I will admit, when they got into China and they started attacking walled cities, initially the walled cities posed a threat. But eventually they figured out how to use siege weapons, which they usually took from the enemies they conquered. And as their empire grew, you started seeing Chinese soldiers that were brought in, or Korean soldiers, or Hindu soldiers. They took the best from their enemy, and they applied it to their next foe. And eventually, they were unstoppable. And their armies were completely mobile. FYI, Genghis unleashed his hordes in 1202, but by the 1240s, they were already in Europe. His armies raced across the vast Eurasian landmass in decades. A feat not seen since probably Alexander the Great, did it? And the amazing thing was is that when Genghis Khan died, his sons and his grandsons continued the expansion. They also mastered, terrorism. complete terrorism. They would send an ambassador. They would go to your city's gates. And they would simply tell you, it's time to surrender to the Great Khan. If the city said no, the Mongols would not stop until your city was devastated. They always would get in. And once they were in, they killed everyone. Men, women, and children. Except for one person. They always allowed one person to live. And guess where the Mongols sent that one person? No.
To the other country.
They would send them to the next city in the direction that the horde was coming. Because what would that person... Yeah, that person would be like, you're never going to believe what happened to my hometown. And they would leave a lasting imprint on the city that they ravaged. They typically burn it all to the ground. They would take all of the corpses. They would cut their heads off. And they would use all of the heads and make a pyramid. And that would be left sitting in where the gates of the city was. So that way, if anyone came looking, they would see this kind of symbol of what happened to them. And they would know. To say that they devastated the landscape is an understatement. And the historical record is clear. Any nation that tried sending armies against them were completely paralyzed. Shock and awe was the tactic they used. And they pretty much rolled over everyone. But by the time of Genghis's death, the empire had become so big, it was decided to divide the empire into mini-states. Khanates. And to each khanate went to one of Genghis's sons. And then eventually it would be passed down to grandsons and so forth. Now, they did keep one as the Great Khan. But this allowed each of the khans to solidify their control over their domain. Now, what does this have to do with Western civilization? Well, this is why, right here, the Golden Horde. This would be the Khanate that would penetrate Europe. But to make it simple, we'll focus on the two ways the Mongolians impacted Western Europe. One, definitely negatively, and one, surprisingly positive. The first is the direct threat. Conquest. The Golden Horde was established in 1223, and it was entrusted to Genghis's oldest son, Jochi. Jochi was the first of the Khans to invade Russia. Although it wasn't Russia then, it was called the Kievan Rus then. And they unleashed terror. They easily shattered the Russians' army, but they didn't conquer. They came in, caused destruction, and then retreated. The reason being, this was meant to be a probe. Let's gauge the opposition. Thirteen years later, the great Khan, Ogedai, ordered the conquest of Russia. Jochi, unfortunately, had died, so that task was given to Batu. Batu would, over the next 5 years, from 35 to 37, he would defeat every single Russian army that was sent against his forces. He actually killed the ruler, the Grand Prince, and actually burned Kiev to the ground, or Kiev. And he claimed the land for the Golden Horde. Russia was conquered. But once he had Russia, he then invaded Europe. In 1240, Batu would launch the first probes into Poland. And in doing so, he did something the Poles had never seen before. Instead of coming in with one fell swoop, he took advantage of Mongolian tactics, and he sent three armies in, going into Poland from different directions. Well, as it turned out, it only took one army to defeat the Poles. But all three armies would end up fighting European forces. Because once the attack on Poland was broadcast, other European states sent troops to go help the Poles out. The closest being the Hungarians. Well, in retaliation against the Hungarians for sending troops against the Mongolians, the Horde swooped into Hungary, killed half of the population. 50% of the people that were living in Hungary, dead. Killed. Then they continued to push onward. No one could stop them. They pushed in as far as the Czech state. Death. Destruction. But, out of sheer luck, one nation did something that had never been done before. They stopped them. The Bohemians. Bohemia was a region in the mountainous areas of what today is the Czech Republic. When word reached their king that the Mongolians were coming, he knew the only way the Mongolians could get to him and his people was to come through the mountains. And he knew the tactics of the Mongolians, using their lightning strikes with their cavalry units, could not work going through narrow, tight mountain valleys and gorges. So, he ordered the strengthening of the defenses of all the entryways into Bohemia. And would receive reinforcements from some of the German states. Well, as the Mongolians try penetrating, they have to sometimes march in these narrow valleys into Orion, single or double rows. And that basically allowed the Europeans to use their bows and their crossbows from high elevated positions and rain down death on the Mongolians. Bohemia, as a result, was the only Eastern European country not to be molested by the Mongolians. So, when they could no longer go this way, in later years, the Mongolians would attempt to come back again, but they would go south, primarily into the Balkan regions, swiping into modern Austria, going back into Hungary, eventually getting down into Croatia and Bosnia and Bulgaria. But, unlike what they did to the Rus, they didn't stay. They simply came through, caused death and destruction. Now, here's the amazing thing. Stories of what were going on, of course, spread all the way to England, and there was actually talk of the Western European states mobilizing a crusader-type army to march to go help out the Eastern Europeans. But as quick as the Mongolians came, they left. Part of the reason why is the survivors of the death learned. They learned from the Mongolian tactics and they adapted. So what did they do? They started building bigger, stronger defenses around their cities. This is around the time when in Eastern Europe, they switched from wooden walls around their cities to stone structures. They also did not leave their walls and go attack the Mongolians. They stayed behind their walls and defended their cities. But their most effective defense, whenever they heard the hordes were coming their way, they would burn the grasslands. They would burn the countryside. Because the one thing the Mongolian army was dependent upon was grass for their horses. So if you burn all the grass, their horses have no food, which means their horses potentially could die. This is the reason why they stopped trying to conquer and they just simply did raids. But the raids continued for about 80 years. But the raids themselves were nothing on the scale of the invasion that began in 1240. But the death was high. Like I said, 50% of Hungary, I think it was like 40% of Poland. I don't remember the other countries' percentages, but we're talking lots of death. Ironically, the Mongolians themselves eventually gave up these violent raids when many of their soldiers converted to Islam. And they began to shift from raiding in violence to commerce. The horde began to trade heavily with the Italians. Because one of the amazing things that we're going to see in a minute was that what the Mongolians did is they reopened the Silk Road for the first time in hundreds of years. So the Mongolians made sure all of those silks and spices and all the fancy stuff that the Europeans wanted was brought to Italy and eventually dispersed throughout the rest of the continent. And that takes me to the second impact, cultural impact. This became the focus of the empire. Well, actually, me rubbing my fingers probably doesn't do anything. So we'll do this. Well, I don't have much, but we'll just say this. This is what makes the world go round. Sure, I can kill you, and I can take all your stuff. But eventually, I'm going to use up all your stuff. But if I can do business with you, I can continue for long, sustained periods of time to take little bits from you, little bits from you, little bits from you. And over a lifetime, I'm going to get more from you than I could if I could just kill you and take what you had at the time. Now, the Mongols always viewed trade favorably. Because after all, they were nomads. They were dependent upon getting those things that they couldn't make for themselves. But as the empire grew, again, it stretched literally from China all the way into Europe, the farther they went, the more items they discovered. They discovered tapestries and rugs and different types of narcotics and porcelain and just all the things that the world could produce. And they wanted a little bit of a taste. So what did they do? They opened up free trade. They established fortifications along the Silk Road to ensure that merchants could travel from the Mediterranean world all the way into the heart of China unmolested. Any criminals on the Silk Road that were caught were crucified and left to die. And by the way, Mongols use the X crucifixion, not the cross. They also built roads to extend. One of the most successful things they did was they established a secure route into the Indian subcontinent. They built post stations and rest stops. And as a result, Western ideas came to Asia. Asian ideas went to Europe. The Silk Road is most significant for an unprecedented knowledge transfer. Medical knowledge was exchanged. Weapon technology was exchanged. Gunpowder? Who invented gunpowder?
Chinese.
How do you think the Europeans got it? I think the Mongolians. The Mongolians also developed and expanded the use of paper money. Why would you want to use paper money instead of coins? Exactly. And it's easier to hide. They also established new forms of banking and insurance to protect caravans of goods. And pepper and ginger and cinnamon and nutmeg and other spices began coming into Europe in larger quantities. What happens to prices when supplies increase? When supplies increase, prices do what? Prices decrease. So for the first time, middle class people, commoners, could afford to put some spices on their food. It wasn't just a luxury item for the kings and queens. And of course, this inspired a huge advancement in ship technology. Because how are you going to get the goods out of here to Europe? Well, you need bigger ships that can travel faster. Because where there's a demand, there's customers. And where there's customers, there's money. And again, it was a two-way street. Western merchants and missionaries and diplomats They all traveled as far east as they could go to the legendary city of the Great Khan, Xanadu. Although the most famous one of these people was a guy called Marco Polo. Marco Polo was a Venetian trader who was brought to Asia by his father and his uncle, who had traveled the Silk Road several times. And as Marco came of age, they decided to bring him into the family business. But an amazing turn of affairs, in 1275, he was actually abandoned in the palace of Kublai Khan by his father. He was kind of held as a hostage because apparently Marco Polo's father had fake credentials, the equivalent of like a fake ID, and he got busted for it. So he basically had to go back to Europe to raise enough money to pay a fine. Well, Marco Polo was left behind just in case his father never came back. And he actually stayed in the realm of the Khan all the way until 1292, until eventually the Khan just let him go home. But he wrote about his experiences in Asia. And he brought to Europe the first depictions of what life was like in Mongolia and in China. And his book, A Description of the World, became a bestseller at a time when the literacy rate was less than 5%. It was really one of the first books translated into multiple languages. And, believe it or not, it served as a basis for global travel for centuries to come. FYI, in 1492, when Columbus set sail across the ocean blue, he was trying to reach a land described by Marco Polo as Zimpagnu, which today we call Japan. That's where Columbus was going for. And when we get to Columbus, his measurements, his estimate on the length of the trip, was in part based upon Marco Polo's measurements of how big Asia was. The problem was is that Marco Polo described Asia as being 8,000 miles bigger than it actually was. So that's one of the reasons why Columbus thought he could get there. In 30 days. We'll talk about that down the road. The Mongols also allowed for the spread of religion. They, despite the fact that they were brutal killers, were tolerant in terms of the world's religions. Christians were allowed to enter and open up churches. Muslims were allowed to enter and open up mosques. Heck, the mother of Kublai Khan converted to Nestorian Christianity. He also allowed several papal missions to come. Cardinals came on behalf of the popes. Kublai Khan also allowed the establishment of an archbishopric in Peking, making it the first Christian church in China. And sermons were preached in Mongolian and Chinese. Heck, when Marco Polo's father had to go back, he actually brought with him a letter from the Great Khan asking the Pope to send 100 of his greatest scholars to come to the capital to help him develop art and culture. Amazing stuff when you think about it. They conquered, they killed, they destroyed. But then once they were in control, they opened their doors. All for this. Now, the biggest impact this had, of course, on Western Europe was, again, they got a taste of those items in quantities that reached the lower levels of society. And it piqued curiosity among men. Ooh, wouldn't it be cool? Look at how Marco Polo describes Xanadu. Oh, wouldn't it be cool to go there and go see the wonders of the world? Questions? All great. All great. Except for one of the other things that the Mongolians brought with them. Dum, 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 dum. Death in another form. Arguably one of the most destructive events in human history. The coming of the Black Plague. Now, unlike the last pandemic that we had to deal with, the COVIDs, this didn't primarily kill the people who had other medical issues, because that's the truth. You know, and sadly, most of the people that died because of COVID is because they had pre-existing conditions. The plague was an equal opportunity killer. It killed men, it killed women, it killed healthy people, it killed sick people, it killed the old, it killed the young. It killed nobility, it killed peasants. No one could run from it. But when you dig down below the surface, the most interesting thing about the plague was one of the most interesting things about the plague was that Europe was softened up. Europe had been softened up because in the decades before it appeared, the health of the average European was diminished significantly because of natural occurrences. When one looks back in the decades before the first reported incidents involving the Black Plague, one should be taken aback that there were reports of 7 years of just bad times that the contemporaries referred to as the seven lean years. They were basically trying to make an analogy with the biblical seven lean years that are discussed in the book of Genesis. Now, what triggered the lean years? Meaning lean, like they're not growing enough food. You know, unlike what most people think of today, where your food comes from the grocery store, the fact of the matter is your food, if it's real and not processed, actually has to be grown and raised and produced. And if there's bad weather, there's no food. And if there's no food, you die. Well, what caused it was the weather. 1315, 1316, the people alive that wrote about the times said that there was climate change going on. There was significantly above average rainfall combined with below average temperatures. Now, the problem with this was the primary crop that they grew. Does anyone know what the primary foodstuffs eaten by Europeans was back during the Middle Ages? Nope, not corn. Not potatoes. No, not fruits. Wait, who said that? Well done. Wheat, grains. Grains. Do you know where wheat comes from? Thank you. Wheat is a grass. But when it grows out of the ground, it's the sprout is topped up by the seeds that gets pulverized into flour. Which means the plant is top heavy. The problem with wheat is it requires almost perfect growing conditions. It needs to be just about the right temperature, and it needs to be just about the right rainfall. But if there's too much, particularly around the time when the crop is getting ready to harvest, all of the moisture wicks into the seeds and the stem stalk breaks. The moment it touches the ground, it begins to rot. So, for two growing seasons, food production began to diminish. So, peasants in particular got desperate. They were prepared to do anything to try to survive. They slaughtered their animals. But of course, if you only have two cows and you kill them, what's going to happen next year? No cow, no meat. They are definitely reports of cannibalism. If you're hungry. Oh, any of you ever hear the fairy tale? Grimm's Fables? Hansel and Gretel? That's a basis of a true happening during this time period. Parents simply sat back and said, we don't have enough food to feed the family. So we're going to abandon our kids in the woods, let the wolves eat them, because we will make more babies. Well, as if that wasn't bad enough, literally, climate change occurred. So don't think climate change is a new thing. There's always been climate change. But what made it worse was, all the way up until about 1300 AD, right when this occurs, Europe experienced about 500 years of way above average temperatures. On average, 3%, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, not 3%, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than the average global temperatures. FYI, today, with all our global warming or whatever they're calling it now, we still haven't reached the global temperatures that were in place when this occurred. Well, because temperatures were warmer and it was drier and better farming conditions, more food could be produced, so you ended up with more people. So then suddenly the Earth threw a curveball. And by the way, the population in Europe in 1300 was higher than the European population all the way up until the 19th century. So there were more people alive in the 1200s than there were in the 1800s. Go figure. But then, here's the curveball. Global temperatures went from high and did a sudden reverse. And another 6th century event called the Little Ice Age. From the 13th century all the way to the 20th century, global temperatures dropped 6 degrees Fahrenheit below the 1,000-year average. So now what does this mean? We have colder winters. We have cooler summers. And we have shorter growing seasons. As a result, The cold winters, the cool, wet summers resulted in more crop failures. And as a result, you ended up having famine. Now, by the way, one other little interesting factoid I have in here. Sea ice grew to an extent that experts believed there had never been as much on Earth. But of course, the little ice age came to an end late 19th century, early 20th century. And so as the sea ice began to shrink, icebergs broke off. One of the ironic consequences of the end of the little ice age was the Titanic. It hit one of those icebergs that had broken off of the massive North Pole ice cap. All right, what does this have to do with the Black Death? Well, here you go. You eat less food, you're taking in less calories. If you have less calories, it means your body lacks the ability to fight off diseases. Diseases that your body normally could fight off. Plus, you have less energy, which means you're going to have lower production. And lower production means you're going to be able to work less on your farm. You're going to be able to produce less commodities to trade or sell. And as supply diminishes, what happens to prices? Prices go up. Now, by the way, the first groups impacted by this were babies and the elderly. In 1317, there's references to several pandemics. There were outbreaks of pneumonia and bronchitis and tuberculosis. In 1317 alone, it's estimated that somewhere between 10 and 25% of European population died from these pandemics. And then if that wasn't bad enough, in 1318, some type of animal virus breaks out and kills flocks of sheep, cattle, oxen, even horses. To this day, no one has figured out what it was. So now you have no livestock. You can't work your fields. You can't make any money. Death. Soon, people just began abandoning homesteads, leaving their houses and wandering, trying to find better places to live. And of course, the impact of that was complete economic collapse. Can't call it a depression. Actually, we could call it a depression. But it was so bad, we have no numbers on it because they didn't have a economy then. It was agrarian. But if you can imagine a 50% decline in production, think about the ripple effect. Questions? Well, let's make it worse. It appears once they got by the seven lean years, things didn't improve, but they stabilized. Beginning in the late 1320s. It seems there was a slight uptick in the 1230s. Nothing major. But unfortunately, death struck again in the 1340s. What happened? Ships carrying grain from the Ukraine, which was not impacted completely like most of Europe, sailed out of the Black Sea into the Mediterranean, going to European ports, but in addition to the grain, had stowaways on board. Thousands of rats. The rats were laden with millions of fleas. Fleas that had in their bloodstreams the bubonic plague. Where did the plague come from?
Europe.
What?
Europe.
No. In the lands that the Mongolians devastated. The first recorded outbreaks of the plague occurred in the middle of Asia. And it's believed to have something to do with the Mongolian tactic of taking dead corpses and catapulting them into the cities they were laying siege to. Apparently the people got sick. The fleas bit the sick people, and the fleas bit the next person, and the next person, and the next person, and eventually this bacteria was established and transmitted. So these fleas got on the rats, because the rats were attracted to the grain that were on these boats. And as the boats arrived, bringing food, which was the thing they needed, the Black Death was unleashed. And the Black Death was not fun. Any of you have animals? Cats, dogs? Get fleas in the house? You've never had fleas in the house? What do you have, cat or dog?
Both.
Both? You let them go outside?
Mm-hmm.
Never had any fleas as a result?
Well, I don't let my cat go out.
Oh.
She's indoors. Or a dog, yeah.
Oh. Do you put like flea collars on them and stuff like that? All right, that helps. Anyone ever have like a flea outbreak in your house? It's not easy. It's not easy to get rid of the fleas. They have little blood cells. Well, they're tiny. You can't see them. And they bite. Not fun. The fleas that had the plague would bite the people. Because let's be honest, they didn't have clean living conditions. Most of the houses had dirt floors. And typically, like, when you were done with your food, there was all scraps and stuff down on the dirt floors. I mean, they lived in dirty conditions. They didn't have bathrooms. They didn't have running water. So in the dirt and the grime, the fleas thrived. And they would come and they would bite the people. Symptoms would appear 2 to 6 days after you were bitten. What it would begin with is a growth the size of like a walnut. And it would appear in your armpit, in your groinal region, or on your neck. Eventually it would swell up to the size of a small apple. This boil, or buba, which is where the disease's name comes from, caused agonizing pain. Your skin around it felt like it was on fire. It just burned. Absolutely agonizing. Now here's the funny thing. If the buba was lanced, the moment it appeared, like popping a zit, it gay and thoroughly drained and cleaned out, there was a chance that you could survive. But nobody knew this. So those people who got it and had this treatment, it was just sheer luck. So there was no internet. There was no medical schools. There was no CDC. Most of the people had no idea. But if you didn't do it within the point of it first appearing, it's too late. Because once it hits that full growth, the patient then hits the secondary stage. Your veins begin to rupture. Now, you all know that your color of your blood is actually purple, right? It only becomes red when it gets exposed to oxygen. Well, what the plague did is it ruptured your veins. And so what ended up happening was black spots begin appearing underneath your skin. At that point, you're dead. Because the moment that begins to appear, you begin to cough violently. You begin coughing out blood. Because at that point, there's millions of these bacteria that's infected your bloodstream. The moment the first black blotch appears, you got 2 to 3 days left. Then you're dead. Now, to make things scary, apparently there was also a pneumonic form of this as well. So it wasn't just fleas, but it could be transmitted person to person through spit, coughing and sneezing. In both forms, penetrated everywhere. It raced all across Europe, as well as across North Africa. Between 1347 and 1351, an estimated one-third to one-half of an already weakened population died. Entire communities were wiped out. Cities like London and Paris and Florence and Hamburg saw death rates of 60%. That's half. Half of the people. In Germany, this stat alone is just horrifying. In Germany, in 1340, there were approximately 170,000 settlements, from the biggest cities to the smallest village. But by 1450, that number shrunk to 40,000. Entire towns, entire cities were depopulated. It's believed that somewhere between 100 and 200 million people died, which caused the world population to shrink by 20%. And the worst part is the plague just didn't stop then. It came back multiple times. In the 1360s, it reappeared. In the 1370s, all the way until the 1670s, every few decades, there would be outbreaks. Although nothing to the scale of what happened in its first go-around. And the plague changed the European landscape forever. The entire societal and economic structure was flipped on its head. Previously, there was always just enough workers to do what was produced, what was necessary. But as a result of like half of the population dying, suddenly there's a labor shortage. The result of this was the workers could actually command a demand for more wages. And peasantry began to be reduced. The lords couldn't keep the peasants on the fields anymore because the peasants would be like, sorry, go pound sand. I'm going to go to the city and I'm going to use my hands and I'm going to go and make money. So even rural workers started getting wages. Because there was so much death, land prices went down. You could literally get, I think the equivalent was in, I think it was France, I saw this stat. You could get 100 acres of prime farmland for today's modern equivalent of about $50. Why? There just was that few people. And, ironically, those people who survive suddenly were able to eat more food because there were less mouths to feed. Any of you see the Avengers movies? Thanos? What was the whole reason for the snap? Well, to cut the population in half, right? Because if there's half as many people, those who survive live twice the good lives. So, new fields available. There's now more meat on the market. Everything changes. Everything changes. And people began to rise, economically speaking, for the first time since the Roman times. Now, of course, one of the bizarre consequences of this was that the governments of Europe began to react. In order to keep the commoners in their place, many of the states in Europe began passing what's known as sumptuary laws. Sumptuary laws. These were laws that separated the consumption of goods between classes. So, for example, laws on the books dictated who could buy certain materials to make clothing out of. There were laws on the books that determined who could eat certain foodstuffs. Who could have certain types of furniture in their houses? Obviously, the nobles got the best, which meant the commoners were not allowed to get as much. I got a couple of examples. I got three examples. First, in England, there was a law that said all males, except for nobles, had to wear wool hats. If they tried wearing a hat made out of anything else other than wool, they would be fined. Nobles, however, could wear fur hats. One of the reasons why England passed this law was one of their primary commodities was wool. So they wanted to artificially boost that sector of the economy. But imagine the government telling you what type of hat you could wear. Well, current administration wants to tell you what type of stove you can have, but and what type of car you can drive, what you can ingest in your body. All right, so I guess our government's doing that. All right, that's fine. In France, nobles and nobles alone could wear velvet or have gold lace on their clothing. If you were a commoner and you had something made out of velvet, fine. Here's my favorite one, though. And this was in the state of Florence, one of the Italian states. All women, except for those who paid for a license of 50 florins, which is the equivalent of about $1,000 today, couldn't show cleavage. If you paid the license, you could have a low-cut dress. But if you didn't get the license, your neckline was at the base of your head. Crazy times. But again, they established the us versus them, a separation between the elite and the commoners. Another interesting consequence. Slave trade appeared in Europe for the first time since Roman times. Wealthy estate owners became desperate to replace the labor that they lost. Now, by the way, the slaves that were brought in were not Africans. Because you all know that it wasn't just Africans who were enslaved, right? Every race was enslaved. No. The slaves that they brought in were the slaves that were brought to them by the Mongolians. And they were mostly people from the Slavic regions. Ukraine, Crimea. And by the way, that's the reason why in English we call it slave. Because it was the Slavs who were brought in. It also inspired like literal witch hunts. The Black Death would trigger a renewed religious fervor. Because where is this coming from? Surely it must be proof that God is angry with his people. There is so much sin in the world. Surely this is the equivalent of one of the ancient plagues that God brought down onto mankind. So, many people became uber religious in attempts to win God's forgiveness. So how do you do it? You root out sinners. You get them out of your community. Of course, the most popular targets were Jews. A very popular rumor that was spread throughout the continent during this time was that the plague emerged when the Jews poisoned wells. But it wasn't just Jews. It was gypsies, foreigners, poor. Heck, even those who had acne could be singled out and targeted. Oftentimes, they were literally ripped apart. Any of you seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail? That scene when they have the witch? That's the type of mob persecutions that occurred. Now the impact was that many, many communities, including over 200 Jewish communities, were forced to completely uproot and migrate. And of course, many of them ended up in Poland. But complete fanaticism, witch hunts. And the last point of the day, because our time is up, almost, is another fascinating aspect, was a change in artistic expression. An entire genre appeared known as the danse macabre, the dance of death. You are so removed from death, it's not even funny. We don't see death. Even if we lose a loved one, we don't see them. Chances are a loved one passes away in a hospital. Their body is then transferred to professionals that hold the wakes, and the family can gather and say their last goodbyes, but it's not hands-on. We're isolated. We don't see it. We hear about it in the newspapers. But imagine the scale of death when one out of every two people die. You could walk down the street and there are corpses everywhere. Monty Python, the Holy Grail. Bring out your dead! But the danse macabre, the people began to almost like cult-like worship death. Because they realized one thing, and this is the big point. No matter what your position in life was, death comes for us all. Last thing. You know how morbid it was? It's a very popular song that dates back to this time. Ring around the rosy. Rosemary breeds. Pocket full of posies. The type of flowers that grow on graves. Ashes, ashes. Because everything gets burned, we all fall down. On that happy note, what's due on tomorrow? If you haven't done so already, how are you going to send me your topics?
Email.
Don't forget. See you.